Racial realities in Europe. Italy, Spain and Portugal by E. Lothrop Stoddard. One of the most widespread errors which exist today is the belief in a Latin race. The traditional idea is that southwestern Europe is Latin, that France, Italy, Spain and Portugal are sister nations inhabited by peoples of kindred blood. This idea has, to be sure, strongly influenced the course of European politics on many occasions, and yet it is a delusion. The truth of the matter is that there is no such thing as a Latin race, but that, on the contrary, the so-called Latin peoples differ widely from one another in a racial makeup. Viewing these countries from the racial angle, the first thing that strikes our notice is the fact that in all three countries, a large proportion of the population belongs to the Mediterranean race, the slender, dark-complexioned stock, which thousands of years ago occupied the lands bordering the Mediterranean Sea and has ever since remained the most numerous element in those regions. Now, just to remind people that by dark-complexioned here, what he means is brunette in hair colour and don't burn in the sun. He's not talking about Mediterraneans being mixed with Negro blood. By dark complexioned, he just means a darker shade of skin. Still white people. It used to be the meaning of the term swarthy before we ended up with mulattoes. Because white people have a wide variety, a wide diversity of hair colour and eye colour. We're not all just the same colour. However, we should note two things. In the first place, we must not confuse the terms Mediterranean and Latin. In the second place, we must realise that the original Mediterranean stock has been greatly modified during its long history, so that it has come to vary widely at different times and in different places. Loose usage of the words Mediterranean and Latin has caused endless confusion, and the distinction between the meaning of the two terms must be clearly understood before the actual state of affairs in southwestern Europe can be appreciated. The term Mediterranean has a purely racial meaning and refers, as already stated, to the slender, dark complexion stock, which in very ancient times settled the lands about the Mediterranean Sea and also pushed northwards across France to the British Isles, where it still survives, especially in Wales and Ireland. The word Latin, on the other hand, is not a racial but a historical and cultural term, harking back to the Roman days. Central Italy was the Roman heartland, and with the growth of Roman power, the Latin language and Latin culture spread over southwestern Europe. Not merely all Italy, but also France, Spain, and Portugal were thoroughly Latinized, and today the peoples of those countries speak tongues and possess cultures alike derived from the old Latin source. Unquestionably, these similar languages and cultures are ties, making for sympathetic understanding among the southwest European peoples, and yet their significance must not be overestimated. History proves conclusively that such ties do not bind beyond a certain degree unless reinforced by the subtler yet closer tie of kindred blood. That is the reason why observers who disregard the racial factor are so continually fooled. Judged merely by speech and culture, the peoples of southwestern Europe seem well fitted for close and harmonious association. Accordingly, political prophets have often preached the doctrine of Latin fraternity and have advocated pan-Latinism, in other words, a league of Latin peoples. And yet despite all such eloquent preaching, pan-Latinism just does not take place. The reason, of course, is that the doctrine is based on a delusion. the delusion of confusing likeness in speech and manners with kinship in blood. The peoples of southwestern Europe differ from one another in racial makeup far more widely than is usually imagined, and these racial differences largely counteract the ties of culture and speech. Whoever gets to know the Latin peoples will discover one thing as curious as it is significant. This is the fact that the more these peoples are thrown together, the less they like one another. So long as their contacts are merely superficial, so long as they exchange courtesies or read one another's books, feelings of friendly similarity tend to arise. But let them come into intimate contact, and the chances are that they will quickly and instinctively discover marked temperamental differences, which will be more apt to drive them apart than to draw them together. This is particularly the case with Frenchmen and their southern neighbours, but it is also true in lesser degree as between Italians and Spaniards, and even as between Spaniards and Portuguese. In every case, a study of the facts will bring to light differences in racial makeup, which account for the temperamental differences that exist between the so-called Latin peoples. Of course, the presence of a large Mediterranean element in the populations of Italy, Spain, and Portugal creates between these peoples a blood relationship which is almost wholly absent as between them and the French, who are mainly Alpine or Nordic in race, with very little Mediterranean blood. In this basic sense, therefore, Italy, Spain, and Portugal can be considered as forming a block of kindred peoples, which may be classed together as the Mediterranean South of Europe. However, as already remarked, these three peoples are racially much less alike than they superficially appear, and a just estimate of their respective situations can be gained only by viewing them separately, as we will now undertake to do.
Tune in to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
Italy is by far the most important nation in southern Europe. The medieval might of Spain has long passed, while the short-lived glory of Portugal is but a dim memory. Italy, however, recently emerged from centuries of eclipse, has forged her political unity, increased her material prosperity, and today displays a spontaneous vigour which augurs well for her future. The long peninsula of Italy juts out from the mass of continental Europe far to the southwards, bestriding the waters of the Mediterranean Sea, and through its island appendage of Sicily, almost touching North Africa. Italy is long and narrow in shape, its fancied resemblance to a jackboot being a geographical commonplace. Including its island dependencies, Sicily and Sardinia, Italy's area is about 118,000 square miles. On this area lives a population of nearly 40 million, rapidly increasing in numbers. Italy is a well-defined geographical unit, sundered from the European landmass by the massive rampart of the Alps and washed elsewhere by the sea, Italy's boundaries are clearly traced by nature. This natural isolation has been enough to ensure the impress of a common language and culture upon all the inhabitants of the peninsula. It has not, however, been enough to keep out numerous foreign influences. The mountain chain of the Alps is broken by passes through which invading hosts have often poured. Also, the seas which bound Italy are narrow and easily crossed from the opposite shores. In fact, Italy has for ages been racially modified by two contrasted streams of incoming population, one entering the country through the Alpine passes of the north, the other descending upon its southern coasts from lands to the eastwards or from North Africa. This is the basic reason for those pronounced racial distinctions which characterize the Italian people today. Another factor making for racial diversity is Italy's internal geography. The peninsula itself is mainly mountainous, thus breaking up the land surface into many small districts separated from one another. Only in the north is there a really large stretch of plain country, the broad valley of the Po. These two geographical factors together give the key to Italy's racial history. Today, as in the past, Italy is divided into two sharply contrasted regions, inhabited by populations of a very different character. To the north lies the rich Po Valley, a natural magnet for invaders from beyond the Alps. To the southward stretches the narrow and mountainous peninsula, becoming ever more rugged and broken, relatively unattractive and inaccessible to landward penetration from the north, yet open to landings from the sea. We are now able to understand Italy's racial history, which has followed closely the lines traced by nature. The earliest inhabitants of any lasting significance were the Mediterraneans, the slender, dark-complexioned people who entered the peninsula many thousands of years ago, coming apparently both from the eastwards through the Balkans and from the southwards by way of northern Africa, settling the entire peninsula. Together with its island appendages, Sicily and Sardinia, they make Italy for a while a solidly Mediterranean land. Presently, however, their title to sole ownership was challenged. Through the Alpine passes to the north began to flow that succession of invasions which has so profoundly modified Italy's destiny. At first, these invaders were men of the round-headed, thick-set Alpine race, who gradually conquered the Po Valley, expelling or absorbing the Mediterraneans and turning northern Italy into the predominantly Alpine land which it has ever since remained. Later on, tall, blonde Nordics crossed the Alps, conquering the mixed Alpine and Mediterranean populations of northern Italy and establishing themselves as ruling aristocracies. In time, these mixed tribes under Nordic leadership pushed southwards, modifying the racial makeup of central Italy, but rarely penetrating to the extreme south, which remained almost solidly Mediterranean in blood. Rome is the leading example of the peoples which arose as the outcome of these prehistoric migrations. The Roman people, in its early days, was clearly of diverse racial origin. Like most of the great peoples of antiquity, it was composed of a ruling aristocracy, differing sharply in race from the mass of the population. The Roman patricians, the ruling class, were apparently Nordics with a perceptible dash of Alpine blood. This is clear from the busts which have come down to us, most of which show plainly Nordic, sometimes startlingly Anglo-Saxon, features, combined with a broadish head betraying an Alpine strain. The predominantly Nordic racial makeup of the Roman ruling class is made equally clear by a study of the Roman temperament, which was plainly Nordic in its political and military ability, love of order and stern devotion to duty, yet also showed an Alpine cross by its rigidity, limited vision and lack of creative imagination. The Roman plebeians seem to have been mainly Mediterraneans, steadied by a fairly strong Alpine infusion, and with a few Nordic traces. It is interesting to observe how sharp was the consciousness of racial differences between the two orders of society in early Rome. The patricians, as Nordic aristocracies have always done, long kept the purity of their blood by stern prohibition of intermarriage with the plebeians, thus maintaining their hold upon the state and impressing their spirit so deeply upon Roman institutions and customs that their ideals persisted long after the patrician class had lost its Nordic character. This nature of the old Roman spirit needs to be emphasized because it has been so widely misunderstood. The prevailing idea is that the early Romans were small dark people, in other words, Mediterraneans. This is a serious error, because it misinterprets the very source of Latin civilization. As a matter of fact, a glance at Roman ideals and institutions shows that these were patently Nordic, with Alpine modifications. The truth is that down to the fall of the Republic, when Rome ceased to be racially Roman, the spirit of Roman society was emphatically un-Mediterranean. To think of the stern, practical, unimaginative Roman patrician as a typical Mediterranean is nothing short of ludicrous. It would have been clean against the Mediterranean racial soul, which, wherever found in anything like racial purity, whether in ancient Greece or in modern Ireland, is always basically the same. To find the Mediterranean spirit in ancient Italy, we must look not to Rome, but to those states of southern Italy and Sicily, which were Rome's early rivals. Here, indeed, we discover the Mediterranean soul at its best, its artistic gifts, its hot emotions, its quick imagination, its love of form, colour and life. Here also we find that extreme individualism and political instability, which have ever been Mediterranean weaknesses and which brought southern Italy under Roman rule. The Roman period needs to be examined not only because it set an indelible stamp upon Italian ideals and culture, but also because it produced important racial changes in the Italian population. Modern Italy can, in fact, be understood only in connection with its Roman past. The legacy of Rome was both good and evil. Rome made Italy for centuries the centre of the world and bequeathed a wealth of glorious memories which must ever stir Italian hearts. Today, as in other days, Italians are steeped in the Roman tradition, and Italian leaders, from Rienzi to Mussolini, turn naturally to ancient Rome for inspiration. The fascisti, with their legions, their classic salute, and their symbol of the fasces, the axe bound with rods, are indulging in no vain theatricalities. These things are the instinctive expressions of a people with whom old Rome is still a burning memory. Such is the bright side of Rome's legacy to modern Italy, yet there is a darker side. Rome, though mistress of the world, dealt the Italian homeland wounds which fester through the ages. The evil aspects of Roman society, the drain of foreign conquests and civil strife, the curse of slavery, these and other baneful factors impoverished and degenerated the population, not only of Rome itself, but of all Italy, so that when the Roman Empire finally fell, it left behind an exhausted, enfeebled stock, unable either to carry on the traditions of Roman civilization or to defend itself against its enemies. For centuries, Italy became a mere geographical expression, the helpless prey of foreign invaders. Particularly deep and lasting was the racial damage suffered by the South. Northern and central Italy gradually recovered energy and ability, owing both to the vitality surviving in the native stock and to the incoming of superior new blood. But the population of southern Italy and Sicily was so thoroughly drained and degenerated during Roman times that it has ever since been inferior in quality. Here, as in some other parts of the Mediterranean basin, the Mediterranean stock today ranks below its level in ancient times. The early Mediterranean inhabitants of southern Italy and Sicily were vigorous, gifted peoples who produced gracious and colourful civilizations. These civilizations, however, faded out in a cycle of strife ending in Roman rule. The south fell on evil days. The countryside passed into the hands of Roman land speculators, who parcelled it out into great estates, latifundia, worked by gangs of slaves, mostly drawn from inferior Asiatic and African stocks. The dwindling remnants of the native population crowded into the cities, became pauperized proletarians, and intermarried with freed slaves and nondescript immigrants, also largely drawn from the Levant and North Africa. It is from this population of later Roman times that the modern South Italians and Sicilians mainly descend. In them, the presence of Asiatic and North African strains is today plainly visible, these strains having been not only implanted in Roman times, but further reinforced during the Middle Ages, especially in the period when southern Italy and Sicily fell under Saracen rule. Far happier was the course of events in northern and central Italy. To begin with, these regions were not racially impoverished during the Roman period to anything like the same extent as the south, while comparatively little admixture of inferior Levantine and North African elements took place. Furthermore, the fall of Rome was accompanied by a series of barbarian invasions, which, however destructive at the time, brought in much good new blood. These invaders were mostly Nordics, and the Nordic stream from beyond the Alps continued to flow for centuries, leavening the populations of northern and central Italy with Nordic energy and creative ability. The growing vigour of the northern Italian stock presently displayed itself by the rise of strong city-states like Venice and Florence, and by a splendid outburst of artistic and literary ability, crowned by geniuses like Dante, Michelangelo, and Raphael. It is true that the constant civil wars and foreign invasions which afflicted Italy down to recent times killed out much of the best stock, so that the population of northern and central Italy today is not the equal of the population 5 centuries ago. Still, the present population of these regions is unquestionably a good stock, physically sound and revealing its latent qualities by its ability to produce strong, gifted personalities. The rise of modern Italy to political unity and material prosperity during the past century was made possible largely by a series of remarkable leaders like Mazzini, Garibaldi and Cavour, while the present fascist movement has brought to the front a number of distinctly able men, culminating in the extraordinarily dynamic figure of Mussolini.
You're tuned in to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
Anyone who has travelled in Italy realises the sudden change which takes place south of Rome. Rome is, indeed, the dividing line between two sharply contrasted regions. Northwards are progress and prosperity, southwards lie backwardness and poverty. This is precisely what the racial situation would lead us to expect. The two halves of Italy are inhabited by very different breeds or men. The northern half contains the best of the old Mediterranean stock, plus a strong Alpine element and a considerable leavening of Nordic blood. The southern half is peopled by a racially impoverished Mediterranean stock, long since drained of its best strains and in places mongrelized by inferior Levantine and African elements. By recognising the peculiarities in Italy's racial makeup, by realising the wide differences which exist not merely between specific racial elements in the population, but also between the characters of similar racial stocks in different regions, we can get a far clearer idea of the course of Italian national life than would otherwise be possible, while much that at first sight seems strange becomes understandable. When Italy at last became a united nation half a century ago, she was faced by a multitude of problems requiring delicate handling and special treatment. In the economic field, Italy has been distinctly successful. Although primarily an agricultural country, Italy has, nevertheless, built up a prosperous industrial system, of course, in the north, despite the handicaps imposed by lack of coal and other raw materials. Socially, Italy has also progressed, the general level of well-being, education and other social factors being markedly higher in the north and distinctly better even in the backward south. Italy's most serious difficulties have been in the field of politics. to forge a real national state out of such diverse and long-sundered elements was a Herculean task, particularly difficult, as the creation of political institutions congenial to the Italian character. Certainly the course of Italian political life has hitherto left much to be desired. Italy started out with a set of political institutions modelled on the parliamentary democratic ideals of England and France, but this borrowed system did not prove a brilliant success. Once the patriotic fervour of the first days had died away, Italian political life was controlled by a caste of professional politicians who gradually evolved a system known as Transformismo, a sublimated pork barrel which ate the heart out of Italian political life. Behind resounding party platforms and fine phrases, the professional politicians framed deals and made elections, keeping one eye on the people and the other on the treasury. When public opinion got too much aroused, there would be an election and a change of government, but this really meant little more than a shuffle of political offices among different gangs of the same professional crowd. The situation was further complicated by the fact that there were not two well-defined political parties, as in America, but a number of political groups, so that ministries were usually formed from blocks, bound together more by the desire to get office than to do anything constructive once they were actually in power. The upshot was that Italian political life was wasteful, inefficient, and above all, purposeless. As for the general public, continually duped as it was by this political shell game, it became increasingly bored and disgusted with the whole business, which was just what the professional politicians wanted, as lack of public interest left them a freer hand to play their political games. In the years just preceding the Great War, to be sure, signs of vigorous popular discontent began to appear. This was best shown by the rise of several new political groups which stood, frankly, outside the old political system and possessed genuine programmes of action instead of mere party phrases. The most forceful of these new groups were the syndicalists, who wanted a social revolution, and the nationalists, who demanded a strong imperialistic foreign policy which should make Italy a greater power in the world. Bitterly hostile to each other though they were, syndicalists and nationalists alike condemned Transformismo and preached the need of political realities. However, they were but minorities, controlling few electoral seats, and so had very little direct effect on Italian parliamentary life. Then came the war. After grave setbacks, Italy emerged victorious, only to have her aspirations disappointed at the peace settlement. Exhausted, disillusioned, and exasperated, Italy fell a prey to internal disorders which threatened civil war or revolution. The old political caste, which had badly mismanaged the war, proved quite unable to face the crisis at home. Things went from bad to worse. A succession of weak governments did nothing but temporise and play petty politics. Italy seemed on the verge of chaos. Then came Fascismo, a small but determined minority, headed by able leaders, chief among them Mussolini, banded themselves together, fought and defeated the Bolshevik elements who were planning a social revolution, then turned upon the government, which had been supinely looking on, overthrew it and established a frank dictatorship. For nearly 2 years, Mussolini and his fascist blackshirts have been the undisputed masters of Italy. With the material results of fascist rule, the world is passably acquainted. The order, efficiency, and prosperity which it has brought to Italy are well known. What is not so well known, however, is the spirit of Fascismo and the exact character of its ideals. Fully to appreciate Fascismo's significance, one must go to Italy and meet personally the fascist leaders. To do so is a rare and stimulating experience. In present-day Italy, one immediately gets a sense of freshness and vitality. people are thinking frankly and acting boldly. Theory and precedent are disregarded in favour of natural impulse and common sense. To think of fascism as a mere reaction against Bolshevik plots and governmental weakness is to miss utterly its real spirit and its larger meaning. Fascism goes much deeper than that. It is nothing less than a vivid and vital outpouring of the Italian spirit, seeking to forge new institutions and new ideals in harmony with the mind and soul of the Italian people. That is what gives it both its present strength and its lasting significance. Specific acts of the fascist government may be wise or unwise. The whole fascist regime may be but a pioneering venture, destined soon to evolve into something quite different. Nevertheless, all this does not touch the basic fact that fascism has set a stamp upon Italian life and thought which will endure. The kernel of fascist philosophy is realism. Probably the fascist spokesmen will object to my use of the word philosophy, because so sternly realistic are the fascisti that they deny having any such thing. Having theories as they do, they strive to keep their minds from crystallizing around general ideas. Instead, they seek to face specific situations as these arise, to judge them from the observed facts of the case, and to deal with them in the light of common sense. Precedent, consistency, logic, these things are, in the fascists' eyes, mere nonsense. Fact, the fascisti claim that it is just because of undue reverence for such things that not merely Italy, but the world in general, is where it is today. According to the fascisti, the world has long been going on a wrong tack. For the past century or more, say the fascisti, we have become increasingly obsessed by theoretical abstractions condensed into phrases or single words which we have set up like idols and to which we have superstitiously bowed down. Consider some of our present-day idols. Their names are democracy, liberty, equality, rights, parliamentary government, and more besides. Look at them closely. What do they really mean? In themselves, they mean nothing. Theoretical abstractions that they are, they have no concrete significance. Yet there they sit, like gods in a heathen temple, paralyzing the creative thought and energy of mankind. Before them, we meekly lay our problems. Is this not so? Look you, a situation confronts us. What do we do? Do we study the special facts of the case, and then act according to those facts in the light of our common sense? We may do this in our private lives, but we rarely do so in public matters. Instead, we seek the will of our idols. In other words, we try to find a solution which will be democratic, or which may not offend such sacred principles as liberty and equality. What arrant nonsense, cries fascismo, and what dangerous nonsense too. Such idolatrous blindness gets us nowhere, or rather, it lands us in a bog of troubles. Therefore, down with our idols, down with democracy, down with equality, out with the word rights, save perchance when coupled with the word duties. Sweep these fool gods into the dustbin along with the other fallen idols of the past. Thus, and thus only, may we clear our vision, free our common sense, and regain the path of true progress. Such is the uncompromising realism of fascismo. The fascisti have indeed the courage of their convictions. No established institutions for them. Relentlessly they ask, does it work? Is it efficient? Is it suited to our people? And if the answer is no, then out it goes. The same is true of ideas. Mussolini's special publication is called Gerarchia. Significant name. Gerarchia is the Italian word for hierarchy, And in its pages, we find a theory of society which flouts the doctrines of democracy and equality in no uncertain fashion. Instead of preaching men's equality, Gerarchia stresses their inequality, men being thus unequal. Democracy, in the ordinary sense of the word, is an absurdity. Mussolini's ideal social structure takes the form not of a level plain, but of a towering pyramid. He glimpses a society in which individuals will be ranked according to their natural capacities and limitations. But even their most cherished ideals, the fascisti insist upon a realistic basis. For example, the fascisti are nothing if not patriotic. The power and glory of Italy are ever in their minds, and yet their patriotism is neither mystic nor sentimental. On the contrary, it is rooted in realism. I well recall a discussion I had on this point with one of the fascist leaders. The talk turned on the nature of Italian nationalism. "I will explain to you," said the fascist leader, "how our nationalism differs from the nationalism of most other peoples. Elsewhere, you will find nationalism largely based upon abstract rights and historical precedents. We fascisti disregard all this, as besides the point. For us there are no abstract rights, not even the right of a nation to bear existence. A nation, like an individual, must deserve its existence, and must continue to deserve it. For example, we fascisti do not claim that our Italy acquires any special rights, because on this geographical area there was a Rome, a Cinquecento, a Risorgimento, because its soil nourished a Dante or a Julius Caesar. No, our belief in Italy's present and future greatness rests upon what we living Italians are, do, and will do." Bold words these, and very refreshing to one who, like myself, had recently been in Central Europe and the Balkans, or had listened to long, laboured nationalist arguments, often based upon a conquest by King so-and-so, or a victory of General What's-His-Name, gained perhaps many generations before. This bold spirit and confident optimism of the fascisti undoubtedly spring in great part from the fact that fascismo is emphatically a young man's movement. Not for nothing does fascismo's inspiring marching song begin with the words, "Giovanezza, Giovanezza, youth, youth." Fascism has swept old-line politicians and bureaucrats wholesale into the discard. Mussolini himself is only 40, while few of the fascisti leaders are more than 45. As already remarked, fascismo is clearly a spontaneous Italian product. Its methods and ideals are precisely what a study of Italy's history and racial makeup might lead us to expect. Mediterraneans everywhere instinctively crave strong, dynamic personalities to lead them, while Alpine stocks seem to do best under the guidance of able, ruling minorities. Mussolini and his lieutenants therefore appear well fitted to accomplish much for Italy and to lead their people along paths suited to the national character. Perhaps we may even be able to witness the creation of new political institutions better suited to a mixed people of Mediterranean Alpine origin, like the Italians, than were the parliamentary democratic forms borrowed from England when Italian political unity was attained half a century ago. The fact is that democratic parliamentary institutions have been a real success only among peoples largely Nordic in blood. The idea that they can be applied indiscriminately to peoples of all races is precisely an example of that abstract theorising against which fascismo is today voicing so healthy a protest.
You're tuned in to Radio Storm.